crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. We're coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel, as per usual. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for listening last week. I only normally check the email account for Watch Jerusalem maybe once or twice a week. And I only checked it just before this program, and I hadn't checked it. It's been such a busy week. I hadn't checked the letters at watchjerusalem.co.il for a week, and we had a number of emails in there from you in response to last week's program regarding the upcoming exhibit that opens a week from today, and a number of you requesting to get the exhibit brochure, and I will make sure that you get a copy of that if you write into our website. I just actually got back from the printer here earlier in Jerusalem for the reception. We're going to have a number of brochures on hand here, and they are going to be printed here in Jerusalem. The ones that will be at the exhibit back in Edmond, Oklahoma, they will be printed in the United States. But I just saw just a couple of copies, trial copies, or the first copies to come out from the printer here, and the brochure is absolutely beautiful. It is, I think it's about 40 pages, a beautiful cover and a lot of pictures and graphics, a timeline, pictures of the artifacts themselves. More than just retelling the story in the Bible, it really does make an effort inside this brochure to look at the science of these discoveries as well, so that we give a really balanced approach to this, and so we can capture the largest possible audience as well for this exhibit. It's important for everybody to see the information here, the history from the Bible alongside the secular history. And so as those people did request it, I'll make sure that we can get you a copy of that brochure as well, wherever you are in the world. Also, some other exciting developments. We are going to launch our new watchjerusalem.co.il website, .co.il website. That will be coming out this week. Not exactly sure what day it's going to go live. We've been working with it for the past, more intensely for the past month, I would say, just to upload a lot of the content that's already on the current Watch Jerusalem site, as well as include a number of features that don't exist in the current Watch Jerusalem site. I think you'll love it. The layout is a lot nicer. There is a large map of Israel there with the numerous archaeological sites. You can even zoom in really close. I think it was Reese Zollner, one of our workers back in Oklahoma, that put this map together, and he's done a wonderful job. It's still in its infancy. There's a lot of information left to add, as you can think of all the excavations in Israel. There's a lot to add on there. But if you do zoom into Jerusalem on this map on the front page of the new website when it comes out this week, well, you can even see the walls of the Palace of David, as well as the Solomonic era structure that Dr. Elot Mazar has been uncovering for the past few years on the Ophel as well. So that's a really neat feature. We're also featuring a number of videos on there. We're also going to feature the exhibit itself. That will be live streamed, at least the opening. Again, that's going to take place at 7 p.m. Jerusalem time, or 11 a.m. Back in Oklahoma, Central Time in the United States. And wherever you are else in the world, you can check up to see when that will be live. But there is a specific page dedicated to the exhibit, and we're going to have video of the exhibit itself. I believe that is going to be filmed tomorrow. I was speaking with the curator of the exhibit. He's back in Oklahoma right now. All the artifacts are in. The curator as well from the Antiquities Authority spent a couple of days in Edmond, Oklahoma, helping us out. A really nice lady. I didn't get to meet her in person, but I was told that she was just very helpful and very impressed as well at the exhibit. Mr. McDonald, he's the curator. He sent me a few pictures of the artifacts in the cases, as well as the reconstruction the replica, really, of a part of Hezekiah's tunnel. And having been through Hezekiah's tunnel a dozen times or so, it does look good. It looks very good. And I'm sure those people that can't travel to Jerusalem, that can travel to Edmond, Oklahoma, will really enjoy getting a feel for Hezekiah's tunnel, being able to walk through this. And so really do avail yourself of this resource, and that's what it is. It's a resource that combines archaeology and the Bible together, and the ancient sources and the Bible together, and really does take you step by step through this important historical event. And so please go and see that. Check into the new website. I'll certainly tweet and post on Facebook as well this week when we do have this new website going live, so that we can get your feedback. There might be a few little tweaks and twitches that need to be fixed as any website goes live. We have been trying to deal with a lot of it. Patrick Hogan back in the United States has been working very diligently on this to try and tweak out any bugs. But if you do see any bugs with the website, please go ahead and email letters@watchjerusalem.co.il so that we can attend to those and make it the best possible website we can. And anyway, there have been also some people here from Israel. I think about 10 people so far that are Watch Jerusalem listeners over here that are going to attend the opening event. Again, Dr. Elot Mazar is going to be speaking. The chairman of the Armstrong International Cultural Foundation that's affiliated with Watch Jerusalem, Gerald Flurry, he is going to be speaking as well. And then we're also excited to announce that the deputy minister, member of the Knesset, Michael Oren of the Kulanu Party, he will be visiting and he will be speaking also at the exhibit opening here in, or at least the reception here in Jerusalem. He is somebody that used to work with Dr. Mazar before he was a member of the Knesset back in the early 2000s. And he is, I would say, by profession, he's a historian, and he's probably the man that knows about the relationship, historic relationship between Israel and the United States, better than anyone, I would say. He did write a massive book about that a couple of years ago. I think that's actually while he was working at the Shalem Center here in Jerusalem. And then he was personally selected by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to become the ambassador to the United States, the Israeli ambassador to the United States. Mr. Oren did grow up in the United States, and then he did make Aliyah. I'm thinking it was back in the 80s. I can't remember, late 80s, I believe. But he did have dual citizenship, and in order to accept the post as a representative of the State of Israel, accept this post that Mr. Netanyahu asked him to fulfill, he had to renounce his U.S. citizenship, and so now he is just an Israeli. But he is a very interesting man, a lot of experiences relating to his time period as the ambassador to the United States. These were the very crucial years of the early Obama administration, and he was, you probably don't need to be told that Mr. Obama didn't have a close affection for Israel. In fact, there was a great hatred, it seems, for the state of Israel, the Jewish state, and that could be seen ever since his first speech abroad, the Cairo speech, that really looked like it was an outreach to the Muslim nation to try and bring them alongside, bring them into the international community. And then the keynote part of that speech was talking about how no nation has the power to look at another nation and say, you don't deserve nuclear power. You don't deserve, he didn't say nuclear weapons, but a nuclear program. And so after that was back in 2009, then we had the beginnings of this nuclear negotiation that would culminate in 2016 when it was implemented in January. But even though it was sold by the Obama administration as being this deal that came about because the moderate Rouhani came in power in 2013, we know that they were working on this deal back as early as 2009. They wanted this deal. They wanted to get closer to Iran. And the man that had the front seat looking at that, that the way they are working behind the scenes, the Obama administration with the Iranian nuke deal, as well as how his relationship was and his staffer's relationship was with the Israeli state, with Mr. Netanyahu, that was Mr. Michael Oren. He saw it up front, face to face, personal animosity against the Jewish state from the Obama administration. And I would say he saw that probably better than almost anyone. That would have been such a difficult, difficult task to be the ambassador of Israel's ambassador to the United States, based in the United States, of the Obama administration. I would not envy that job whatsoever. Anyhow, he does have a lot of that history under his belt. He also has a love for the Jewish state. He feels it's very important that this these archaeological discoveries are being made, and he will be coming to speak for about 10 minutes or so at the opening event here in Jerusalem as well. Again, if you want to get some tickets for that, you won't be getting a ticket. If you want to come, all you need to do is email RSVP at armstrong.foundation, or you can email me at letters at watchjerusalem.co.il and avail yourself of seats at this event. It should run for about an hour, and I can give you the official invite if you reach out to us. And so please do that. Some other people are doing that, that listen to the program here in Israel, and that's just very exciting. That's all I actually have time for today. I am going to replay for you, though, a program that I did about a year ago, and it has everything to do with archaeology of the time period of King Hezekiah. We recorded this program at the time because Christopher Eames, one of our main archaeology writers, he put together a massive piece on Hezekiah and the archaeology related to his time period. And so I thought, since I don't have much time today in preparation for the exhibit, and that we have this recorded segment from about a year ago that is super current in preparation for the exhibit opening, I thought we would play that for you. We are going to take a break. When we come back, it'll be the interview from about a year ago with Christopher Eames.
This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive. Thank you for listening.
As one of the workers emptied a trowelful of dust and rocks into a bucket, little did he know that he had just transported from the ground what would be among the greatest discoveries ever made in Jerusalem, one of the greatest single items surely ever discovered throughout all Israel. And as that bucket was carefully sifted, first a dry sifting and then a wet, even after the tiny precious object buried within was discovered and cleaned, nobody paid it much attention. Nobody fully realized what it really was and what it said. And so, for 5 years, it was boxed away, waiting. As other incredible discoveries came to light from the Ophel through the intervening years, little did anyone realize that one discovery far more significant had already been found, just waiting to be understood. That's one of the opening paragraphs to a feature story entitled Hezekiah, A Story, A King, A Legacy, written by Christopher Eames. I have him on the line via Skype from our office in the United Kingdom. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Brent.
So I wonder if you can explain more of this dramatic discovery. You've put it in dramatic terms, so it better follow through on this. And I wonder if you can just tell us more about this dramatic discovery at the Ophel.
Sure. I centered this article, which is really about the entire life story of Hezekiah. I began with centering it on this amazing bulla find. That's what these small stamp seals are called, bulle, the plural. And this was a little seal that was found on the Ophel bearing the words, belonging to Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah. And the discovery was made in 2010. It wasn't fully realized till 2015. And when it was realized, it was an amazing moment, because while bulle had been found in the past belonging to King Hezekiah, no one was sure whether or not they were forgeries. They were found on the antiquities market, being sold and transferred. No one was sure whether or not this was a real thing belonging to King Hezekiah, which is so amazing about this bulla, which was found on the Ophel excavation. I have some artistic license with the worker there who was shoveling it into the bucket. That may have been yourself, who knows. There were a couple of workers there digging in that fill. with you. But yeah, an amazing discovery here that shows the scientific proof of King Hezekiah from an untouched layer for 2,700 years. So I basically take this one small bulla find and extrapolate that into the whole life of Hezekiah and all the other different artifacts that have been found dating to his reign.
So just sticking with this bulla for a moment, so it was, as you brought out in this article, I guess it was kind of misread initially and just kind of boxed away. And then once they came back to do the final or write up the final report years later, half a decade later, all the bulla, all the seal impressions, they come back out from their boxes and then they get reread and studied more intensively. And I guess, you know, it is incredibly interesting. They say sometimes the most exciting find is found on the last day. And here we were five years later with this seal impression coming to the surface, if you like, at least to be read for the first time. So I just wonder if you could just put it in significance, like that find itself, this seal impression, as far as going 100 years of excavation in the area of Israel, how significant is this seal impression amongst other biblical finds?
Well, it's very significant because it specifically delineates a king that ruled in Judah. There's several things that this bulla alone proves. One is that there was a king called Hezekiah in Jerusalem. Another is that there was a king called Ahaz, his father, in Jerusalem, over Judah. And the bulla also states that this was the king of Judah. It proves that at that time, the kingdom of Israel was split with the kingdom of Judah. There was a separate king of Israel and a separate king of Judah. So we've got a number of things that this bulla proves to us.
So as far as like any other kings, have they been as attested to through things that we've dug up in the ground?
I think Hezekiah, on the whole, is one of the most attested to kings in all the Bible. There's a lot of through archaeology, and there's a lot of other artifacts that attest to other kings. But what we're finding now is, rather than the odd name here and there or the odd city being discovered relating to biblical archaeology, we're finding whole stories being corroborated here. And such is the case with Hezekiah, with other kings as well. In particular, Hezekiah, there's been quite a lot found dating to his life. And so that's what I wrote this article about, centering it around this bulla and then the amazing amount of other artifacts that connect to this bulla and prove the full story of his life as told in the Bible.
So let's get into that story a little bit. And I guess the place to kind of start would possibly be with his father, Ahaz, but then also the rising empire on the scene being the Assyrian Empire. So could you just set up give us the setting for King Hezekiah's life?
Sure. We'll briefly touch on his grandfather, Jotham. This was a righteous king, and the land of Judah enjoyed much plenty under his time. And then after him, we have Ahaz, Hezekiah's father. And this guy has a major turn for the worse. He delves into paganism, as described in the Bible, and he really has a terrible reign. And as a result, curses are brought upon the nation of Judah. We have a rising Assyrian empire. We've got the Syrians that start besieging his nation, the nation of Judah. We have even the northern kingdom of Israel besieging Ahaz's empire. And as a result, we have King Ahaz really reaching out to the Assyrians, saying, of course, he wouldn't reach out to God. This is a pretty pagan, unrighteous king. And so he reaches out to the Assyrians and asks that they can help him against the Syrians and the kingdom of Israel. And so belonging to King Ahaz's time period, we actually have an inscription from it's called the Summary Inscription, an unimaginative title, but it belongs to the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser, who is recorded at the same time as Ahaz. And on this inscription, we find named this king by the long name, by his long name, Jehoahaz of Judah. And we find him listed in this inscription as having delivered gold and silver and precious items to the king of Assyria. So we find that in the archaeological records, and we find that in the Bible. The Bible says he stripped the temple of its treasures in typical unrighteous fashion for him, and delivered it to Tiglath-Pileser so that the Assyrian king would help him. Evidently, the king didn't really give him any help, but that was essentially the record of Ahaz as told through the Bible and there through archaeology as well.
So that's basically the mid 8th century, 700 plus, 740, 730, somewhere in that territory,
right. Yep.
I guess. And so you have him reaching out. And so that was an Assyrian document that was stating that he received, this Assyrian king received tribute from Ahaz. But as you said, it didn't turn out too well for Judah. The Assyrian kingdom
right.
still decided that it was time to come down through this territory into Egypt. Judah's on the way. So does the kingdom of Israel's on the way. What does archaeology say of this period when the armies of Assyria start to march against the kingdom of Judah?
Okay, so the Assyrian kingdom, a burgeoning kingdom, they don't really give Ahaz any help at all. What they do is start overcoming the kingdom of Israel, and this is just as King Hezekiah is coming into office. King Hezekiah takes over position from his father Ahaz. He immediately makes a turn to living righteously, attempting to bring the nation around into repentance and drawing closer to God. And at the same time, rather than having the kingdom, northern kingdom of Israel, being aggressive towards Judah, what we have is Assyria coming in and taking over the kingdom of Israel. So that's no longer a worry for the Jews at the moment, for the kingdom of Judah. It's the kingdom of Israel that is caught up in the attacks from the Assyrians, which happened during the 730s and really climaxed in the end of the 720s, around 720 BC, just before to just after that. The kingdom of Israel was completely taken over by the Assyrians. And so during that time, you have King Hezekiah, who's made a complete turnaround for his kingdom, the kingdom of Judah. They're really trying to do a better job of living according to the Torah, to the commandments of God. And you can see them really being blessed and prospering from the biblical account during that time.
Is there any archaeological evidence of that?
Well, yes, there just happens to be some archaeological evidence belonging to that period. One such particular item of note that I describe in this article, it's from Tel Lachish, next to the gate room in that city, dating to Hezekiah's time period. We find a pagan sanctuary there right alongside the city gate, and that's been absolutely demolished. There's a number of pagan altars there that have their corners smashed off, the horns of the altars smashed off. You can read about that in Amos 3 and verse 14. That's a very symbolic act, just showing utter desecration of this pagan sanctuary room. And this can be attributed to Hezekiah's cleansings at the time of the paganism throughout Judah. And quite interestingly, in this pagan sanctuary, a toilet seat was found, a stone toilet seat that was placed in the corner of this room. And scientists have analyzed the seat and decided it probably wasn't used. It was just there symbolically. And just to show real disgust to the pagan idolatry that was happening in that room. And there's an interesting biblical verse that corresponds with this, you could say, tradition of desecrating something with the toilet seat. And that's found in 2 Kings 10. And just a little quote from that verse talks about the King Jehu and his desecrations of pagan places. And it says that he broke down the house of Baal and made it a draft house or a public toilet unto this day. And so this was an earlier king of the northern kingdom of Israel. And so what you see here is this tradition, you could say, being preserved up to the time of King Hezekiah, being done at the same time as Hezekiah, during, most likely during these very same early purges of the kingdom, really pointing to a righteous turn for the nation of Judah.
So he's righteous for a while, even as the Bible brings out, but then there is a turn for the worse, or at least the level of his righteousness and the fact that he did destroy idols throughout Judah, it didn't stop the Assyrian Empire from being a threat to him. And the Assyrians march through Israel, and they keep on with later kings after Tiglath-Pileser, as you write. They come down, and they are threatening the nation of Judah. What can we find from archaeology? Obviously, the Bible talks about that at length in the book of Isaiah, Chronicles, Kings. But what have they found archaeologically that also refers to this threatening situation for the nation of Judah?
Right. Well, especially at the time of King Shalmaneser Sennacherib of Assyria, by the time he ascends to the throne, getting toward the later part of the 700s BC, we see the Assyrians really starting to sweep into Judah, overcoming a number of cities there. That's described in the Bible, and it's also described in the Taylor Prism. This is a pretty significant artifact that has been found from the Assyrians. It's a record of King Sennacherib and his campaigns against Judah. And it essentially states that I think he conquered 46 cities in Judah, just started sweeping into Judah. Obviously, the Assyrians were very upbeat with their victory over the northern kingdom of Israel under this new king Sennacherib. They really decided to sweep into Judah, and you can see corresponding to this time period probably a slip in Judah in relying on the Egyptians rather than God. There's a few verses that point to that, them relying for protection on the Egyptians, perhaps a slip into idolatry as well. And so at the same time, you have the Assyrian Empire sweeping in and conquering generally these 46 cities. Now, in terms of specifically these cities, one of the greatest examples that has been found of this Assyrian conquering into the kingdom of Judah is again from Tel Lachish. It's a big fortress, elevated fortress. We've both been there and seen that fortress, really impressive mound there. And what is especially impressive is a massive siege ramp that can be seen going right up against the side of this tell. And it dates to this Assyrian invasion here of Lachish, an invasion that's really well documented through the Bible and through archaeology in particular. So you have the siege ramp that the Assyrians built. They've found over 1,000 arrowheads just on this siege ramp, an immense siege that must have happened there. And dating to this and attributed to this period at the palace in Nineveh, Sennacherib's palace in Nineveh, you can see wall reliefs, they're called, long, massive carved portrayals on the palace that depict the siege of Lachish. There's a big inscription there saying something like, "To the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, king of the universe, as he conquers Lachish." And there's massive portrayals of thousands of helmets and off in the distance, Assyrian helmets and soldiers moving their way toward Lachish and building up siege ramps to Lachish. You can see the siege machines on those portrayals and the attacks happening there, Israelites being impaled, Jews there, rather, Kingdom of Judah being impaled and slaughtered. And then as you move along in this inscription, you can see these people being carted off into slavery. And that also is recorded on the Taylor Prism. Sennacherib took, I believe it was just over 200,000 slaves during his campaigns against the cities of Judah. So you've got quite a lot of archaeological attestation to these campaigns by King Sennacherib at this time into Judah.
So he makes it into Judah. He takes out nearly every major city. Well, he does take out every major city, including Lachish, which is the Bible records being the second greatest city in the kingdom of Judah. And then he turns on Jerusalem, which, again, is what the Bible says. Do we have more archaeological evidence of that?
We do have archaeological evidence of that. We see with the Bible story that after Sennacherib took Lachish, he really set his sights on Jerusalem. Now, while he was taking Lachish, we have King Hezekiah desperately trying to stop this king of Assyria damaging his nation. King Hezekiah takes a leaf out of his father's book and strips the temple of its goods, tries to appease the king of Assyria through monetary means, and he ends up failing. The Assyrians also record this donation, this monetary gift that Hezekiah makes, just like the Bible records it. So there's this attestation there. And after they take Lachish, receive this money, don't do anything in terms of leaving, they set their sights on Jerusalem. And so we have King Hezekiah starting to make desperate plans for preparing for this invasion of Jerusalem. We see the Hezekiah tunnel being dug in Jerusalem, described in the Bible, found amazingly in the city of Jerusalem. Really an incredible tunnel there, 530 meters long, dug straight through bedrock. And we also have corroboration in the Taylor Prism for the king of Assyria turning his sights to Jerusalem. And if we read just a segment from the Taylor Prism, King Sennacherib writes, "As for Hezekiah, I shut him up like a caged bird in his royal city of Jerusalem. I then constructed a series of fortresses around him, and I did not allow anyone to come out of the city gates." And he stops right there. This is the king of Assyria really fortifying himself around Jerusalem. Fortresses, he said, were made. No one could get in or out. And then nothing. He doesn't say if he conquered the city. He doesn't say what he did. The record of what he did against Jerusalem just stops there. And if we look to the Bible, that's incredibly interesting, because we know that the Bible describes an angel of God was sent to wipe out the Assyrian army that was encamped against Jerusalem. And basically Sennacherib, all he could do was to leave with his tail between his legs back to his palace at Nineveh.
Yeah, I think that is probably one of the most interesting aspects of this, just because obviously there's a lot of people that would deny that a miracle took place there to destroy his army. But if you have a king that is, obviously something happened dramatic. He just recorded how many of those slaves he took from Lachish and the surrounding area, 200,000 people, he writes. And then he gets to Jerusalem, and all he can say is, "I shut him up like a bird in a cage." So it looks like that bird wasn't killed. The bird was able to survive the siege. That's what the Bible says. And then Sennacherib goes back to Assyria with his tail between his legs. And the Bible records that he would suffer a very violent death while he was back there. But there's also archaeological evidence for even that as well, right?
There is. Especially within the Babylonian records, the Babylonians who conquered the Assyrians, there's a number of records that point to this death from Sennacherib, not just one or two. And the Bible talks about two of his sons, Adramelech and Sharezer, who killed him. The Babylonian records state that his sons killed the Assyrian king, just as is mentioned in the Bible. And there's even evidence pointing to this Adramelech, as the Bible calls him, or Arda-Melusi, pointing towards him being one of the murderers from a Babylonian letter that states that thy son, Arda-Melusi, or Adramelech, is going to kill thee. So this would have been some correspondence just before the event happened, pointing to this very same man. And his brother, Sharezer, who also killed him, he's also attested to in the records as Nabu Saru Uzer. You can see the link when you see the names put together. Right. Obviously, some different pronunciation between the nations, but you can see both of those sons attested to as being sons of Sennacherib and as being the ones that killed him.
Awesome. So we can see here, and I really will encourage our listeners to read your article here. Again, it's going to be up on watchjerusalem.co.il over the next couple of days. We're also going to feature this in a new segment of our website. It's going to be called Online Exhibits, and it's going to be very colorful, and it's going to have video, and it's going to have nice pictures, and it'll be a complete story in itself. And even as you write here, we're doing the first one on Hezekiah, and you've written this first one on Hezekiah because as you write in your article, you say not only does archaeology validate snippets of the Bible, which we talk about a lot on this show, but more accurately, entire stories. And such is the case with King Hezekiah, one of Judah's greatest rulers. And that's what your article does from beginning to end. Puts the Bible right alongside not just one discovery, such as his own seal impression, even though that's amazing, but even down to the insignificant parts of the story. It seems that we do have both this clear connection between what the Bible says and what archaeological sources from Babylon, from Assyria, and from Judah all say to bring this picture together. That's all we have time for today, Chris. I know you could speak for this for about 3 hours, maybe you will in the future at some point on the program. Thank you very much for filling us in with King Hezekiah here.
Sounds good. Thanks, Brent.
You've been listening to Watch Jerusalem. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can go ahead and email us. And our email address is letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.